16. Mystical States. One of the most compelling factors fueling my decision to make a career of psychedelic research was the similarity between high-dose psychedelic experiences and mystical experiences. Years later, it was these types of sessions I hoped to see, study, and understand in our New Mexico DMT volunteers. The debate regarding the spiritual relevance of psychedelic experiences has raged on for as long as people have used these chemicals for their profound psychological effects. For example, books such as The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience make the obvious connection to William James's early 20th century book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Recently, Entheogens and the Future of Religion continues a long and controversial tradition of recommending that any deep spiritual practice include psychedelic sacraments. In my early visits to the Zen Buddhist community at which I studied, I raised this question with many of the young American monks. Nearly everyone I asked at this training center answered that psychedelic drugs, especially LSD, first opened the doors to a new reality for them. It was the pursuit of stabilizing, strengthening, and broadening their initial psychedelic flash that led them to the discipline of a communal, meditation-based ascetic life. Naturally, I wondered if psychedelic drugs could speed up and simplify attainment of sublime states of mind free of the side effects of institutional practice, such as ritualistic behavior and withdrawal from the everyday world. The answer that did emerge from our New Mexico research was complicated. Yes, psychedelics could induce states similar to mystical experiences, but no, they didn't have the same impact. Even more revealing than these relatively straightforward answers was my Buddhist community's reaction to even asking and discussing these questions. However, I am getting ahead of myself. In order to establish the close similarities between spiritual experience and what is possible with the spirit molecule, I will first review briefly the features of a mystical experience. The three pillars of self, time, and space all undergo profound transfiguration in a mystical experience. There no longer is any separation between the self and what is not the self. Personal identity and all of existence become one and the same. In fact, there is no personal identity because we understand at the most basic level the underlying unity and interdependence of all existence. Past, present, and future merge together into a timeless moment, the now of eternity. Time stops, inasmuch as it no longer passes. There is existence, but it is not dependent upon time. Now and then, before and after, all combine into this exact point. On the relative level, short periods of time encompass enormous amounts of experience. As our self and time lose their boundaries, space becomes vast. Like time, space is no longer here or there, but everywhere, limitless, without edges. Here and there are the same. It is all here. In this infinitely vast time and space with no limited self, we hold up to examination all contradictions and paradoxes and see they no longer conflict. We can hold, absorb, and accept everything our mind conjures up, good and evil, suffering and happiness, small and large. We now are certain that consciousness continues after the body dies, and that it existed long before this particular physical form. We see the entire universe in a blade of grass and know what our face was like before our parents met. Extraordinarily powerful feelings surge through our consciousness. We are ecstatic, and the intensity of this joy is such that our body cannot contain it. It seems to need a temporarily disembodied state. While the bliss is pervasive, there's also an underlying peace and equanimity that's not affected by even this incredibly profound happiness. There is a searing sense of the sacred and the holy. We contact an unchanging, unborn, undying, and uncreated reality. It is a personal encounter with the Big Bang, God, cosmic consciousness, the source of all being. Whatever we call it, we know we have met the fundamental bedrock and fountainhead of existence, one that emanates love, wisdom, and power on an unimaginable scale. We call it enlightenment because we encounter the white light of creation's majesty. We may meet guides, angels, or other disembodied spirits, but we pass them all as we merge with the light. Our eyes now, finally, are truly open, and we see things clearly in a new light. The import and momentousness of the experience stands alone in our history. It may serve to focus the rest of our life toward the completion, filling out, and working through of the insights obtained. Some of these types of experiences occurred in our volunteers within the context of another more compelling category of encounter, such as mind-body healing, being contact, or near-death experiences. For example, Willow's near-death experiences partook of a deep spiritual nature, and Cassandra's DMT tolerance sessions involved more than simply working through personal trauma. She also experienced the presence of deeply loving and healing beings. In this chapter, we'll hear about spiritual experiences that predominated the volunteers' sessions. These DMT sessions were some of the most satisfying of the research. Since Elena's and Sean's came relatively early in the studies, they supported the validity and importance of studying the spirit molecule's more sublime properties. By the time Cleo's spiritual experience took place, I had already begun the process of leaving the university. Therefore, I cast a somewhat less idealistic eye on her sessions. Nevertheless, if everyone's encounters with DMT had been as rewarding as hers, there would have been less reason to stop the research when I did. Supervising these sessions was relatively easy, at least at first. I knew the territory based upon training, study, and experience. The difficulties emerged in the interpretation of these effects, and my sense of their importance. Were they real enlightenment experiences? How would I know? And with whom could I consult about them? While Cleo's spiritual experience took place later than Elena's and Sean's, it was somewhat less complex than theirs. So I'd like to start with hers. It gives us a good introduction to where the other two subjects' encounters will lead us. Cleo was 40 years old when she started our study. She was legally blind due to a genetic eye disorder. Nevertheless, she had persevered, having earned an academic degree and massage therapy certification. She now was enrolled in a master's program in counseling. Red-haired, petite, and with a fiery spirit, Cleo was born into a Jewish family but later began practicing nature-oriented rituals within the Wiccan faith. Once, while on LSD, Cleo saw a past-life experience in which she was burned at the stake for being a witch. Her father had molested her sexually when she was a child, memories of which emerged for the first time during a recent psilocybin mushroom trip. Curiously, Cleo had suffered from a phobia to snow as a child, hyperventilating and vomiting whenever she was out in it. She no longer was troubled by this irrational fear, having worked it through on psilocybin several years before. I usually don't use the word indomitable, but Cleo is as close to exemplifying that attitude as few people I know. Her reasons for volunteering reflected her pioneering altruistic spirit. "I am curious. I think I am ready for the next step. I believe in this type of research from an academic stance and believe there may be a valid clinical therapeutic use for hallucinogens." When I met Cleo in room 531 the afternoon of her screening low dose, she was drawing tarot cards from her deck. The ones she picked were of butterflies and voyagers, optimistic themes. At 15 minutes after the injection, she commented, "There was the lightest feeling of a beckoning for me to follow something. It was like a light on the horizon, like two roads merging with the horizon. There were some eyes looking at me, friendly. They wanted to see who was there, and seemed to say that I would follow them later." The next morning, Cleo asked about the advice I had given her the day before regarding how to prepare for her large dose. "What did you mean when you suggested I go through the colors?" I replied, "It seems like people can get entranced by the colors, If they can go through the curtain that the colors seem to represent, there often is more information and feeling than just the colors themselves. At 19 minutes after her high-dose DMT injection, it started snowing outside. I recalled Cleo's old phobia to snowflakes. Laura rose from her seat and turned up the thermostat. "Rick, I can see why you became a psychiatrist."
"Why?"
"To give this to people." I told her she was right. I had the expectation that I would be going out, but I went into every cell in my body. It was amazing. It wasn't just my body. Themselves. It's all connected. "Oh, that's what I did. Okay." She laughed at her inarticulateness. By 30 minutes, she spoke more clearly. "I felt the DMT go in and it burned in my vein. It was hard to breathe into it. Then the patterns began. I said to myself, 'Let me go through you.' At that point, it opened, and I was very much somewhere else. I believe it was at that point that I went out, into the universe, being, dancing with the star system. I asked myself, 'Why am I doing this to myself?' And then there was, 'This is what you've always been searching for. This is what all of you has always been searching for.' There was a movement of color. The colors were words. I heard what the colors were saying to me. I was trying to look out, but they were saying, 'Go in.' I was looking for God outside. They said, 'God is in every cell of your body.' And I was feeling it, totally open to it, and I kept opening to it more, and I just took it in. The colors kept telling me things, but they were telling me things so I not only heard what I was seeing, but also felt it in my cells. I say felt, but it was like no other felt, more like a knowing that was happening in my cells, that God is in everything, and that we are all connected, and that God dances in every cell of life, and that every cell of life dances in God." In a letter she sent several days later, Cleo wrote, "I am changed. I will never be the same." To simply say this almost seems to lessen the experience. I don't think that anyone hearing or reading this can truly grasp what I felt, can really understand it deeply and completely. The euphoria goes on into eternity, and I am part of that eternity. Cleo was ready and well prepared for her DMT sessions. Thus, when the spirit molecule called in room 531, she leapt up to answer. In her session, we see many of the hallmarks of a mystical experience: the suspension of normal boundaries of time and space, the ecstatic nature of the encounter, and how poorly words function in describing it. She experienced the certainty of her own divine nature, and that all her questions were answered in these brief but intensely felt moments. Elena was one of our earliest volunteers, and was 39 years old when she began. She was short, wiry, dark, and intense, and her manner was playfully blunt. She lived with Carl, DMT-1, and her daughter in a little village outside of Taos. Elena had taken psychedelics about 20 times in her life. More recent were her almost 100 MDMA experiences, which she believed contributed to her decision to slow down her professional life's trajectory. She sold her counseling business and house and began an intense process of inner work. She hoped her participation in the DMT study might lead to a clearer understanding of my spiritual truths. Elena and Carl were a fun couple. I had known them socially for years. They offered steady and consistent support during the grueling time I describe in Chapter 6. Thus, it's no surprise they became DMT-1 and DMT-2. Elena's non-blind, low-dose session was uneventful. However, she was extraordinarily apprehensive the next day, as I readied the syringe full of 8 times the previous amount of DMT. Her heart rate soared from 65 to 114, and her blood pressure rose from 96 over 66 to 124 over 70, just while watching me prepare the drug. Her widely dilated pupils reflected and contributed to a powerful and unpleasant tension in the room. I tried dispelling the anxious atmosphere by putting the syringes down and quieting myself as best I could. No effect. The energy bordered on out of control. Carl and Cindy felt it too and looked restless. "Well, how about it?" I offered hopefully. Elena gave a game smile. "I'll be okay. I'm just scared of what the unknown will bring. Let's get started." Within 45 seconds of finishing the injection, Elena began groaning, sighing, and sucking her breaths in and blowing them out. The strength of her movements made it impossible to get her 2-minute blood pressure and heart rate. Her hands were cold and damp, and the color drained from her face. Her pulse climbed even higher to 134 by the time I got her 5-minute recording, but her blood pressure held steady. Her head rocked back and forth slowly, and she nodded occasionally. She licked her lips, yawned, sighed, and seemed unable to get comfortable. By 4 minutes, she finally began settling down. The color returned to her face at 13 minutes, and she lay there quietly. 10 minutes later, she began spurting out laughter, which grew to an uproarious level. She began to talk excitedly at 30 minutes. While I took notes, the report she wrote the next day does a better job of capturing what she experienced than does my shorthand. "Before you spoke the words, 'Okay, we're done,' there arose in me an energy so forceful that no words could describe it. It drove my heart. The swirl of color reminded me of the visual experience the day before, but multiplied a millionfold. I could only hold on, remembering not to fall off into the distracting light show. Then everything stopped. The darkness opened to light, and on the other side of space, all was utterly still. Then the words, 'Just because it is possible,' emerged out of nothingness and filled me. The great power sought to fill all possibilities. It was amoral, but it was love, and it just was. There was no benevolent God, only this primordial power. All of my ideas and beliefs seemed absurdly ridiculous. I never wanted to forget this. I was aware I could open my eyes and relate to those around me. But first I had to wait for all this to solidify, to allow the fullness of the experience to congeal, so I could bring it back to the others. I wondered, why come back? I was reluctant to open my eyes. When I did, the room seemed very bright, but otherwise quite as I had left it. Several months later, in the dose-response study, Elena had a chance to revisit this state with a double-blind high dose. This time she was much less anxious before we started. At 20 minutes, she began, "It came on fast and big, and an incredible pressure arose in my head, pushing me back. It blasted me into the realm in which pure living energy begins to take form. As it began to slow down, I saw the process of separated awareness. This slowing down creates form and consciousness. Before the slowing down, it's not there. It's not unconscious, but not conscious. It's real, of its own substance, not fragmented. It's amazing how slowly things move here on Earth. Going out and slowing down into the periphery, to the fringes of it, into form. There is the endless outflow of creation, effortless, and then this vast process takes it back in. My little piece of energy goes in and out too, not more or less than any other piece. You can't die. You can't go away. You can neither add nor subtract. There is a continual outflow that is immortality. The I am notion goes around and around. I have the certainty of that." There were loads of paradoxes. I was not disoriented, but there was no orientation. I didn't know where or who I was, but there was nothing to know who or where it was. I didn't have to wonder what to do next. There are no empty spaces. They were all filled up. While Elena described the essence of her encounter as amoral, her joy and wonder suggest she found it anything but cold or lifeless. Rather, it was love, and she was so happy there she considered not coming back. She understood the cycle of birth and rebirth with the resulting personal certainty of immortality. Like Carlos in the last chapter, she also saw what modern cosmologists propose is the source of the universe. First there is nothing, then the Big Bang, out of which slowed down and cooled particles become the elements of matter. From matter comes our own separate bodies and minds. Sean's story is remarkable for its combination of features. His sessions partake of unseen worlds and entity contact as well as mystical states. However, his enlightenment experience is the climax for which the other types of effects paved the way. 38 years old at the time we began working together, Sean received more DMT than any other volunteer. He participated in every double-blind placebo-controlled experiment, as well as the pilot studies in which we determined the best doses of DMT to use in combination with pindolol and ciproheptadine. He also came in for the DMT EEG study and several psilocybin sessions in our preliminary work with that compound. Sandy-haired, fair-skinned, of medium height and build, he was mild-mannered and low-key in the extreme. Only after spending some time with him did you appreciate Sean's solid character, keen and searching intellect, and wry sense of humor. He was a lawyer at a major Albuquerque firm. However, he worked only part-time so as to allow himself the freedom to pursue his other love, growing a wide range of native trees. He previously had taken LSD around 35 times, and psilocybin mushrooms and mescaline once or twice each. His reasons for participating in the DMT studies were modest, in line with his general approach to life. To experience another hallucinogen. I don't know what to expect at all, but I am not afraid of new experiences, or myself, or what I may do. Sean's non-blind low dose of DMT went well, but the high dose the next day was an aberration. The IV line had worked itself loose, and I inadvertently injected the drug under his skin rather than into his vein. We suspected this, but were not certain until he was well into the full double-blind dose-response study. He got much higher on several of these doses than on what we thought was his first large dose. The effects of this initial non-blind 0.4 milligrams per kilogram dose were quite slow to develop, and not much more than those from his low dose the day before. The injection did feel odd as I gave it, but it did not fully dawn on me that it missed his vein. I didn't think to repeat it. Maybe he was one of the people I anticipated might have little reaction to the drug. During one of the double-blind study days, Sean received what turned out to be 0.2 milligrams per kilogram. Because of his reaction to this unknown dose, I started thinking that indeed there must have been a problem with that first high dose. He thought so too. I'll bet this is the high dose, and that I didn't get the high dose last time. I've never been so high. The grain in the door just opened up. Sean participated early enough in the studies that we hadn't begun using the eye shades regularly, and at first he liked keeping his eyes open. This gave me the opportunity to help him think more deeply about the DMT visuals and their sometimes distracting nature. I wonder if you could focus on that space within the grains of the wood rather than the grain itself. You might go further once you're more familiar with what happens on DMT. The visions and display are not all that's there. I was just at the edge of losing it. I had no sense of what you two were doing, just that you were around. I was glad I knew you both. I would have been self-conscious if you were strangers. His comments about being comfortable with us also speak to the crucial but rarely discussed variable of the relationship existing among those who give and take psychedelic drugs. Comfort with the sitters allows for letting go. Anxiety or mistrust creates the opposite. A few weeks later, he received placebo, which gave him time to reflect upon his previous session. I believe the last trip was a near-death experience. Everything is more alive now. I'm not bored, even when I should be. It was the awe and fear of God. I thought about barely anything else for the first day or two afterward. The desire to talk about it to anyone and everyone faded after 3 or 4 days. It's curious that Sean had such a deep experience without any of us knowing about it at the time. It reminded me to remain alert to how different people were in their comfort or ability to discuss the contents of their sessions, especially right after they occurred. Sean volunteered for the tolerance pilot work, in which we worked out the appropriate dose of DMT, as well as how much time should pass between each injection. One morning, he received 4.2 milligrams per kilogram injections at hourly intervals. As he came down from his third dose, he said, "I couldn't watch it all. It was so busy. Something asked me, 'What do you want? How much do you want?'" Sean mentioned this rather casually. It was his first time. He had spoken of hearing the other. I answered that I wanted to see fewer things, but more of it. That reduced the intensity of the busy, crackling, colorful, Chinese-like panels. It became more manageable and focused. I'm feeling freer about going out there. I'm not lost. I'm asking questions and getting answers. Sean then came in for 4.3 milligrams per kilogram doses at 1 hour intervals. He had an extraordinarily moving day. While my bedside notes capture much of his sessions, the letter Sean later sent to me does an even better job. The first session was a lot of fun. I felt myself lifting off the bed 3 or 4 feet. The visions rapidly developed into an almost sparkling electric blue-green light pattern. I asked, "Are you here again?" No answer, so I watched a low-lying city on a flat plain on the far horizon mutate through a variety of colors and hues, with many ill-defined things floating in the air above the city. Then I noticed a middle-aged female with a pointed nose and light greenish skin sitting off to my right, watching this changing city with me. She had her right hand on a dial that seemed to control the panorama we were watching. She turned slightly toward me and asked, "What else would you like?" I answered telepathically, "Well, what else have you got?" "I have no idea what you can do." Then she stood up, walked up to my right forehead, touched it and warmed it up, and then used a sharp object to open up a panel in my right temple, releasing a tremendous amount of pressure. This made me feel much better than I'd felt before, even though I realized I'd felt fine in the first place. Sean's second dose was difficult because a loud vacuum cleaner passed by the room, and a garbage truck screeched terribly outside the window. Temporarily confused and anxious, he regrouped, but could do little else with the session. Dose 3. For the first time ever, I went into a blank state before the DMT injection. I had no thoughts, no hopes, no fears, no expectations. The trip started with an electric tingling in my body, and quickly the visual hallucinations arrived. Then I noticed 5 or 6 figures walking rapidly alongside me. They felt like helpers, fellow travelers. A humanoid male figure turned toward me, threw his right arm up toward the patchwork of bright colors, and asked, "How about this?" The kaleidoscopic patterns immediately became brighter and moved more rapidly. A second, and then a third asked and did the same thing. At that point, I decided to go further, deeper. I immediately saw a bright, yellow-white light directly in front of me. I chose to open to it. I was consumed by it and became part of it. There were no distinctions, no figures or lines, shadows or outlines. There was no body or anything inside or outside. I was devoid of self, of thought, of time, of space, of a sense of separateness or ego or of anything but the white light. There are no symbols in my language that can begin to describe that sense of pure being, oneness, and ecstasy. There was a great sense of stillness and ecstasy. I have no idea how long I was in this confluence of pure energy, or whatever, however I might describe it. Finally, I felt myself tumbling gently and sliding backward away from this light, sliding down a ramp. I could see myself doing this, a naked, thin, luminescent, childlike being that glowed with a warm yellow light. My head was enlarged, and my body was that of a 4-year-old child. Waves of the light touched me as my body receded from it. I was almost dizzy with happiness as the slide down the ramp finally ended. Of course, we had no idea what Sean was experiencing. My notes at 9 minutes after this third injection simply indicate that Sean stated, "I think I'm down." After filling out the rating scale, he said, "It's interesting. I chose to enter a bright light." I offered general support and encouragement. "I'm glad you chose to go into it rather than waiting and observing." It wasn't too conscious a choice. Faith can be leaping off the cliff optimistically. It wasn't that scary. He paused and smiled. "I can't believe I'm doing this, that you're doing this." Let's return to his letter for notes on his fourth and final dose that day. There were wire people everywhere riding bicycles, like programmed people, like video game people having fun. I watched them. They were blue-green, running all around me, like being in a parking tower. I forget what happened at the end. They did it for a long time. I kept wondering if anything else would happen. Slowly the trip ended, but I can't remember how. The morning was almost over. Sean's face was pale as he removed his eyeshades. He bent his knees up toward his chest. Laura said, "You look tired." "No, I'm not tired. I just feel fuzzy." He looked around the room and at us and sighed. "What a day." Clearly there are striking similarities between naturally occurring spiritual experiences and those induced in certain individuals by DMT. Cleo's, Elena's, and Sean's high-dose sessions were ecstatic, insightful, revolutionary, and profound. All three volunteers were steady and solid people with knowledge of religious concepts. The words they used to describe their sessions are remarkably like those we read from the great mystics of the ages. DMT reproduces many of the features of an enlightenment experience, including timelessness, ineffability, coexistence of opposites, contact and merging with the supremely powerful, wise, and loving presence, sometimes experienced as a white light, the certainty that consciousness continues after death of the body, and a first-hand knowledge of the basic facts of creation and consciousness. While gratified and in awe of these sessions, larger questions began to loom as I heard more of them. Because DMT can elicit mystical experiences, are the experiences necessarily beneficial? Or, put another way, do they have a spiritual effect in those who've undergone them? If they did, I'd feel justified in labeling these encounters truly spiritual. In addition, the occasional negative effects of DMT might be easier to accept in the presence of real transformational experiences in others. These thoughts lead to two separate clinical issues: adverse effects from and long-term benefit wrought by encounters with the spirit molecule. In order to begin looking at the overall balance sheet, let's turn to the dark side of DMT.